when it comes to aircraft carrier operations in World War II, most people immediately think of the Pacific. And then a lot of people will think of the Mediterranean, and some people will even think of the Arctic convoys and the North Sea. But very few people ever think about carrier operations in the Atlantic unless they're thinking about late war and, to a certain extent, mid-war era escort carrier operations. But that's not entirely the correct way to think about it. There were actually quite a lot of fleet carrier operations in the Atlantic during World War II. There just weren't necessarily quite as many as there were in some of the more active theatres. So, thanks to the fine folk over on Patreon who voted for this, today we're going to go through a little quickfire list of some of the major fleet carrier operations that took place in the Atlantic during World War II. And then if you want to hear a bit more about any particular one of them, then obviously let us know in the comments below. If someone's already said the one that you want, then maybe stick a like on it, and then I can see which ones would be the most popular to talk about a bit later on. So with that said, let's look very quickly at some carrier operations in the Atlantic that involved the full-size fleet carriers. Now, for hopefully obvious reasons, most of these carrier operations involved the Royal Navy, because, well, that's the theatre the Royal Navy was operating quite a lot in, but there were some American carrier operations, which we'll cover later on in the video, and one French carrier operation as well. But, with that said, in a roughly speaking chronological order, let's start with 1939. So, we're right at the very start of the war, and the U-boats get to work pretty darn quickly. Within hours of the declaration of war, you have the SS Athena being torpedoed by a German U-boat, and other ships start to get torpedoed pretty quickly as well. Now, bearing in mind, obviously, at this point, there is no such thing as an escort carrier, but there has been a fair amount of interwar training on using aircraft, particularly carrier aircraft, to try and hunt submarines, as well as using destroyers and so forth. And since Germany didn't have any aircraft carriers, and there wasn't an immediately foreseen need to use aircraft carriers to strike at German targets, because, well, that's what the RAF and its strategic bomber force was for, because Germany was still just Germany and a few places they'd Anschlussed up to this point, the Royal Navy decided to send out some of its fleet carriers to conduct anti-submarine patrols. Now, they didn't send them out completely alone. They would send them out with a escort of destroyers and occasionally a sloop or two. But the escorts were relatively sparse for a fleet carrier. We're talking four destroyers, give or take a little bit, maybe one or two auxiliaries if you're lucky. But one of the major problems with using things like sloops was that, well, fleet carriers were fast, destroyers were fast. If you used extensive numbers of sloops and other smaller anti-submarine auxiliaries, then you were tying the formation down to their speed, as opposed to just using destroyers, when you could then proceed at the carrier's full speed. The flip side to that, of course, was that, as with the First World War, there were always far more tasks for destroyers than there were available destroyers, and hence why you'd only have three, four or so destroyers escorting each of the carriers. And the idea was that the carriers would use their air wings to find U-boats. Ideally, if at all possible, the aircraft would then attack the U-boats. And in absolute ideal circumstances, that would actually sink the U-boats. But if that didn't manage to sink the U-boats, the aircraft would also be reporting in via radio and saying, hey, there's a U-boat over here. And then you would detach one or two destroyers to go off and hunt them. And at that point, even if the U-boat dove, this was actually a good thing. Now, you might think, well, hang on, does that mean the U-boat is being all stealthy and everything? Well, yes. However, the underwater top speed of a U-boat is significantly less than the surfaced top speed of a U-boat. So if the aircraft knew where the U-boat had decided it was going to go back under the water, it could communicate that to the destroyers. The destroyers could run up. And if the submarine had been forced to stay underwater, it couldn't have gone very far. So theoretically, the search would be nice and easy. And, of course, with a full-size fleet carrier, you could conduct many searches at once and you could relieve the existing aircraft that were on patrol and have continuous patrols going. All fantastic in theory. And for this purpose, the Royal Navy sent out the carriers Ark Royal, Courageous and Hermes. This, however, didn't last all that long because it turned out with the relatively speaking primitive anti-submarine technology at the very beginning of the Second World War and the small number of escorts, it was actually very difficult to keep the carriers safe. There'd been a very near miss, not even a fortnight into the war, when Ark Royal had sent off aircraft to help a merchant ship that was under attack by a submarine. But it turned out there was another U-boat nearby, and that U-boat launched torpedoes at the Ark Royal. Fortunately for Ark Royal, this time she was able to evade those torpedoes, and her three escorting destroyers then launched depth charges at the U-boat, which was U-39. The depth charge assault was successful, U-39 was forced to the surface, and then subsequently sank because of the damage taken from the depth charges, which was incidentally also the first U-boat kill of the war. But it had come very close to costing the Royal Navy its newest and largest fleet carrier. And then, of course, famously, a few days later, on the 17th of September, the carrier HMS Courageous was also doing a anti-submarine patrol sweep. She had four destroyers with her, but then another merchant ship radioed in and said, hey, we're under attack by submarines. Two of the destroyers went off to help her, which meant that Courageous now only had two destroyers covering her. And between this minimal escort and a bit of luck, U-29 managed to put a pair of torpedoes into Courageous, sinking her in fairly short order. So at this point, the anti-submarine patrols had succeeded in destroying a single U-boat, but it had cost them one of the Royal Navy's fleet carriers, and another one had been near missed. The Admiralty very quickly realised that this was a bit of a losing game, because the Germans would very happily trade in even a dozen U-boats to get rid of most of the Royal Navy's fleet carrier strength. And so by the end of September, the surviving two carriers, Hermes and Ark Royal, had been recalled from that mission and would be sent off to do other things. But the next use of fleet carriers in the Atlantic rolled on almost immediately from the failed anti-submarine hunting groups because, well, there were German raiders abroad, particularly the Deutschland-class heavy cruiser Admiral Graf Spee. And so several fleet carriers were roped into searching for the German raider. This included Hermes and Ark Royal, and notionally the carrier Bern, which was from the Marine Nationale. Bern ostensibly was attached to the battlecruiser-battleship Dunkirk, but the French decided that Bern would probably be better served just staying in port because she was incredibly slow and, Dunkirk would just do better without her, since Dunkirk did, of course, have her own scout planes, and if she was operating without Bern, Dunkirk and the other ships with her could run down Graf Spee, whereas Bern was so slow that Graf Spee could easily outrun her, and you didn't want to leave France's only aircraft carrier vulnerable just in case Graf Spee decided to pick on it while the other ships were off doing something like, you know, looking for her in the wrong place. Hermes, of course, didn't have any success in finding Graf Spee, although it wasn't for lack of trying. There were other carriers that were also looking for Graf Spee, but they were in the Indian Ocean, so not relevant to this particular video. Ark Royal, of course, also didn't find Graf Spee, but she was used as part of a major deception in the aftermath of the Battle of the River Plate to make Captain Langsdorff think that he was completely doomed. With Exeter having gone off for repairs, Ajax and Achilles reported that Graf Spee was skulking in Montevideo. Renown, which was a battlecruiser more than capable of dealing with Graf Spee, along with Ark Royal, were assigned to go and join up with Ajax and Achilles, which would, of course, make any attempt by Graf Spee to break out a rather one-sided affair. But it was going to take them a day and a half to 2 days to actually get there, and during that time, Graf Spee could try to escape. And so the British came up with a bit of a cunning plan. They very happily publicised that Ark Royal and Renown were indeed on their way, while conveniently neglecting to mention exactly how far away they were. But at the same time, they ordered a whole bunch of fuel over in Buenos Aires, which was not too far away from Montevideo. Of course, normally you would only pay for fuel when you're imminently about to use it. Otherwise, you have to pay storage costs and so forth. And so they carefully arranged for a leak to suggest to the Germans in Montevideo that, well, if the British have just bought up a ton of fuel in Buenos Aires, then surely the arrival of Ark Royal and Renown is imminent. They're going to top up on fuel there. And whilst Buenos Aires is a bit further than battleship artillery range from Montevideo, it is well within range of Ark Royal's aircraft. So the minute that Ark Royal and Renown were even vaguely in that area, specifically because of the threat of Ark Royal's air group, the Graf Spee was in a very bad way. And this influence the choice of Captain Langsdorff to then scuttle Graf Spee, even though, theoretically speaking, he could have made a break for it before Ark Royal was genuinely in range. He wouldn't have got too far because of the damage to Graf Spee, but he could have at least moved to another port and made things slightly more difficult. Ark Royal then headed off to have some adventures off Norway in the North Sea, as well as spend time in the Mediterranean. But Hermes did not. Hermes stayed in the Atlantic because while Graf Spee was gone, there were Hilfskreuzer, German auxiliary ships, and the odd German merchant ship sailing around in the Atlantic. And so her role, for a brief period at the end of 1939 and the beginning of 1940, was to hunt these commerce raiders and blockade runners, using her air group, of course, to cover a very wide area. The next use of fleet carriers in the Atlantic would actually be against the erstwhile allies of the British, that being the French, and specifically the Marine Nationale, and this would involve HMS Hermes. Ark Royal would, of course, be involved in the attack on Mers el Kebir, but that was in the Mediterranean. But Hermes, somewhat tragically, ironically, had actually operated with the French out of their base in Dakar, in what was then French West Africa. But a few weeks later, she was back, and Dakar was now under Vichy French control and had the battleship Richelieu inside. This was a little bit of a problem for the British because they didn't really want a French battleship under Vichy control potentially running around and shooting at their stuff in the Atlantic, especially given in the aftermath of Mers el Kebir, the Vichy-aligned Marine Nationale wasn't exactly the biggest fan of the Royal Navy. And so Hermes launched some of her swordfish in an attempt to torpedo and sink Richelieu. They didn't manage to sink Richelieu, but they did manage to inflict some damage with a hit to the stern, and that meant that at the very least Richelieu was crippled for the moment, because although Richelieu wasn't sunk, as we just said, the simple fact was Dakar did not have all that much in the way of major port facilities suitable for repairing a battleship. And so, well, if Richelieu couldn't go anywhere anytime soon at any great speed, that would work for the moment. The attack on Dakar generally was a lot more of an involved operation involving a lot more ships from the Royal Navy. But of course, at the moment, we're focusing purely on fleet carriers. Then it was mostly quiet in the Atlantic for a few months, with only really Hermes around still looking for the occasional German raider in the South Atlantic, including Admiral Scheer, a Deutschland-class sister ship to Graf Spee, which had slipped out at some point. The carrier Furious had also been active in the Atlantic during this early war period, although that had been mostly as an impromptu convoy escort, as she'd gone out into the northern Atlantic looking for German raiders and then been told, hey, well, you know, there's a massive troop convoy coming back to the UK. You might as well escort that on your way back. Both Furious and the small carrier Argus were also used quite extensively, primarily on aircraft ferrying missions heading from Britain down to Gibraltar, thus through the eastern Atlantic, taking aircraft down to Gibraltar for self-defence and also in some cases for flying on further into the Mediterranean, and with Furious especially occasionally popping into the Mediterranean to launch aircraft towards Malta as the war went on and Italy entered the war. But that was generally a fairly quiet affair, except for one brief intrusion by the cruiser Admiral Hipper. Hermes then headed off into the Indian Ocean, which would prove to be her final area of operation. But then there were two major hunts for German capital ships wandering around the Atlantic, one more successful than the other. The less successful one was the hunt for the Scharnhorst and Gneisenau, as they'd broken out into the Atlantic in early 1941 as they executed Operation Berlin. HMS Ark Royal was assigned, along with the battlecruiser Renown, to try and hunt down Scharnhorst and Gneisenau, along with a number of other Royal Navy task groups. However, it didn't go particularly well. To their credit, Ark Royal managed to guess where, roughly, the Scharnhorsts were going to be, and one of her scouting aircraft duly found the German battleships. Then they tried to radio in to report their findings, only to discover that their radio didn't work, which meant they had to observe the German ships, and then they had to fly all the way back to Ark Royal and land, and then manually inform Ark Royal, who then had to tell Admiral Somerville aboard Renown what was going on. And unfortunately, A, that took a lot of time, and B, when the Scharnhorst spotted one of Ark Royal's aircraft circling and taking a look at them, they decided, I know, let's turn north. And of course, the pilot said, well, you know, last we saw the Scharnhorst, they were heading north. So by the time Ark Royal had got more scouting aircraft up into the air the next day, they were looking in entirely the wrong place, and the Scharnhorst managed to make their way back to safety. There was also a rather comical episode during this latter search when they were trying to launch a swordfish to go and have a look for the Scharnhorsts, and the catapult that they were using ended up somehow overcharging itself and fired off at such a great speed that the fuselage of the swordfish that was attached to said catapult was flung violently forward, the acceleration being far too quick, and it ripped the wings off of the swordfish, at which point the swordfish sans wings was promptly flung forward off of Ark Royal and into the sea. Unfortunately, Ark Royal then ran over the helpless fuselage because it was going at a fairly high speed, didn't have enough time to dodge, and the swordfish was carrying depth charges. Now you might be thinking, why was it carrying depth charges instead of a torpedo? Because, well, if you're hunting German battleships, surely a torpedo is better. Remember, this aircraft was on a recon mission. Depth charges weigh considerably less than torpedoes, and a one-aircraft torpedo attack on two German battleships is probably not going to end very well. But if you happen to spot a U-boat, having a depth charge or two on board was held to be quite useful. Unfortunately, in this case, the depth charges went off while the fuselage was underneath Ark Royal, which meant that Ark Royal then needed to go back for some repairs. A few months after Operation Berlin, of course, came Operation Rheinebung, and here there would be two fleet carriers involved. When Bismarck was detected as having sailed, the home fleet consisted of the battleships Prince of Wales and King George V, along with the battlecruiser Hood and the aircraft carrier Victorious, plus, of course, a variety of smaller escorts. In a decision that remains still somewhat controversial to this day, Admiral Tovey decided to send Prince of Wales and Hood out to intercept first. He then followed almost exactly 24 hours later with King George V and Victorious, but this meant that Hood and Prince of Wales engaged Bismarck and Prince Eugen at the Battle of Denmark Strait, while Victorious and King George V were still some distance away, and therefore couldn't take any direct part in the battle, and nor were any of Victorious's aircraft in range. By the end of that day, though, Victorious, through hard steaming, had managed to get in range, and nine swordfish and some fulmars were sent off to find Bismarck. Despite horrible weather and the fact they were flying in the middle of the night, or at least as dark as it got in late May in that part of the world, they did manage to find Bismarck and ended up dropping a number of torpedoes on her. Most of the torpedoes missed, but one scored a hit. The hit itself wasn't too bad. Through a potential combination of possibly the torpedo running a bit shallow and or Bismarck, which was already sitting a little bit lower in the water thanks to flooding from hits from Prince of Wales, perhaps also being in a turn. In any case, the torpedo hit the main armour belt rather than the torpedo defence system and just put a small dent into Bismarck's protection, which, you know, it was an airdrop torpedo. It's not exactly that surprising. However, well, as I said, there was a small amount of damage from that hit. The attack as a whole actually caused considerably more problems for Bismarck because Bismarck had to accelerate and manoeuvre violently to avoid getting hit by all the other torpedoes, and this meant that all the lovely damage control efforts that had been made to shore up the area around where Prince of Wales had hit Bismarck previously, both in the bow and more amidships close to the boiler rooms, was largely undone, and more water came in. Bismarck went even heavier down by the bow. Another boiler flooded. They'd already lost one to flooding thanks to Prince of Wales's hit more amidships. And as a combination result of all of this, Bismarck had to slow down quite significantly to try and patch up the damage yet again. And once she got going, between the loss of yet another boiler and the more fragile nature of the damage control efforts to the damage control efforts, Bismarck's speed was quite substantially reduced. Although Victorious herself wouldn't launch any further follow-up attacks, Ark Royal, along with battlecruiser Renown and the cruiser Sheffield down in Gibraltar as part of Force H, also came out to try and hunt the German battleship, and, well, that didn't go necessarily quite as successfully as it should have done the first time off. Ark Royal sent off 15 swordfish, armed with the latest and greatest in detonation technology, magnetic influence detonators, and they promptly accidentally attacked the town-class light cruiser Sheffield. The only bright spot to all of this was it turned out that the magnetic torpedo detonators were worse than useless, in most circumstances, and either failed to detonate or detonated upon hitting the sea, and thus Sheffield escaped completely unharmed. The Swordfish headed back to Ark Royal, informed Ark Royal that the magnetic detonators were completely and utterly useless, and they decided, okay, fine, we'll just use the old school contact detonator warheads instead. Everybody reloaded, headed out to attack Bismarck again, flew over to Sheffield, said hi. Sheffield pointed in the direction of Bismarck. They all flew off, found Bismarck, and of course hit Bismarck three times. Two more hits were amidships, somewhat similar to the hits by Victorious. They didn't do a huge amount of damage, at least by the reports of the Bismarck survivors later on, although they did do some. But the third hit was, of course, the famous hit that tore up Bismarck's steering and rudder assemblage and left her in a permanent 15-degree port turn. Not only did that substantially slow her down, it left her going in circles until they could re-establish some semblance of control, and that, of course, it, along with the efforts of the tribal-class destroyers overnight, is what allowed King George V and Rodney to catch up with Bismarck the next day and send her to the bottom. There was almost a follow-up attack by Ark Royal on Bismarck that day, and the Swordfish actually showed up, but they wanted the rest of the Royal Navy to stop firing so that they could have a clear run in, because obviously the last thing you want to do if you are trying to attack a German battleship with a torpedo from a Swordfish is for your Swordfish to be ripped out of the sky by a passing 16 or 14 inch shell that's been fired from behind you. Unfortunately, through a case of what appears to be misidentification, when the Swordfish flew around King George V to ask, hey, can we go attack Bismarck, please? King George V is reported to have shot at them with pom-poms, which wasn't very friendly. And of course, the Swordfish took a little bit of umbrage at that and went off home rather than continuing to be shot at by their own side. And that left Bismarck to be put down by a combination of shells and torpedoes instead. Now, outside of the occasional aircraft ferry mission down to Gibraltar, that basically brought an end to Royal Navy fleet carrier operations in the Atlantic, aside from obviously carriers going to and fro for refits and heading out to other theatres, but there were no further combat operations for fleet carriers, mostly because, well, there was plenty to do in the Arctic, in the North Sea, in the Mediterranean, and then later in the Indian Ocean and the Pacific. But that isn't the sum total of all fleet carrier operations. Very briefly, we must mention Bairn, as we said, earlier on in the war, when she was notionally assigned to hunt Graf Spee. She actually spent most of her time in port because she was a bit too slow. But she did have one other major bit of activity in the Atlantic, although it wasn't a combat operation. That was to help transport a whole bunch of the French gold reserves over to America to pay for a bunch of weaponry, which she was going to transport back to France. She was actually heading back to France, loaded up with aircraft and carrying various other armaments, when the news of the fall of France came in and the Vichy government taking over, which caused Bairn to divert to French holdings in the Caribbean, where she'll feature a little bit later on. Right at the very end of the war, she'd serve as an aircraft transport, but that wasn't really a fleet carrier operation. Anyway, that brings us on to the US Navy. Now, the US Navy did actually conduct fleet carrier operations in the Atlantic even before they were officially involved in the war, and that was through the neutrality patrols. Initially, this was done just with the carrier USS Ranger, which was in commission and available in the Atlantic, and she patrolled mostly the Caribbean and the eastern coast of the United States, because that was essentially the limits of the neutrality zone that was initially set by the US government. The carrier Wasp was also in the Atlantic. However, she was actually pretty new and spent the first portion of what for the rest of the world was World War II, working up both the ship and her air group. Most of the neutrality patrols in the early part of the war were done by cruisers and destroyers, but Ranger, along with a few of the older battleships, did conduct their own patrols, as I said, near the Caribbean and the eastern seaboard of the United States to reinforce the idea to the Germans that this area should be left alone. As time rolled on into 1941, Wasp started to take a more active part in the neutrality patrols, along with the carrier Yorktown, which had recently arrived from the Pacific. And of course, Ranger was still there doing her thing. But Wasp had a little bit of a diversion from neutrality patrols because it was decided in summer 1941 that the Americans were going to take over occupying Iceland, the British having taken over Iceland about a year earlier. and in order to provide air cover both to the landings and general air cover in Iceland once the Americans had taken over fully, WASP was ordered to embark a bunch of P-40 Warhawk US Army Air Force fighters to provide cover for the actual takeover itself, or takeover from the British and Canadian forces, and then the P-40s would form the core of an American air group based in Iceland. Although some of the carriers did actually directly escort convoys, the closest anyone came to being attacked by a U-boat, at least as far as the US carriers were concerned, were a few U-boats that were spotted in the vague vicinity of Yorktown. With the attack on Pearl Harbor, of course, priorities changed quite quickly. Yorktown was very rapidly recalled to the Pacific, where she would go on to fight in the battles of Coral Sea and Midway. WASP would remain in the Atlantic for a little bit longer, though. Initially, she headed down to the Caribbean, because remember I said we'd mention Bearn again a bit later? Well, Bearn and other French forces were holed up in the French holdings in the Caribbean, and there was some concern that they may try to deploy and attack Allied shipping. So WASP, along with a number of other ships, hovered around the area, making sure that the Vichy French weren't going anywhere for a bit. WASP then headed over the Atlantic to serve with the Home Fleet for a short time. But that was pretty much the end of her Atlantic operations, as she then went on to ferry aircraft to Malta during the Malta convoy operations in early 1942, before then being diverted to the Pacific, where, of course, she would be sunk during the Guadalcanal campaign. And that left Ranger. Concerns about her speed and her vulnerability, since she basically had no real protection against incoming weaponry, meant that Ranger stayed in the Atlantic for the vast majority of the rest of the war. Most of this activity was aircraft ferrying duty, because after the loss of Courageous early in the war, no one was going to try escorting convoys or conducting submarine and hunter-killer operations using a fleet carrier for very long. And so she ferried US Army Air Force aircraft over to Africa, where they then tried to head over Africa and over to the Far East. She also took aircraft to the UK. She took aircraft to the Mediterranean, and, you know, traveling back and forth across the Atlantic built up quite a few miles. There were two notable exceptions to this general activity. One was a brief period in 1943 when she served with the Home Fleet attacking German shipping off of Norway, but again, that's a bit outside the scope of this video. But the other would be her first true combat deployment, and this was at the end of 1942 when she was partnered up with the Sangamon class escort carriers and formed the main punching power, along with battleship Massachusetts, for the western part of Operation Torch, which then of course led to the Battle of Casablanca, during which she launched her aircraft to attack targets ashore, but also to attack various Vichy French naval forces which tried to oppose the landings. Her air group managed to hit and damage a number of smaller French warships, and of course the most famous thing they managed to do was thoroughly wreck the battleship Jean Bart, which had already been on the receiving end of a number of 16-inch shells from the battleship Massachusetts, as well as an earlier dive bombing attack from Ranger, but a follow-up dive bombing attack inflicted major damage on Jean Bart, which caused the vessel to sink, albeit because she was in very shallow water, it was a matter of settling a few feet onto the seabed. Her continued ferry missions meant that Ranger would basically be the last fleet carrier actually doing anything substantial in the Atlantic other than popping back and forth to other theatres, and this came to an end in spring 1944 when it was considered that the Pacific, at least in large part, was safe enough that even Ranger could be risked there. And so in July, she headed off towards the Pacific. She still wasn't going to be risked on the front lines, but she was used to train night fighting squadrons, which could then be rapidly deployed to carriers like Saratoga and Enterprise, which would go up to the front lines. But apart from those ferry missions, it was really Operation Torch that wrote a line under major fleet carrier operations in the Atlantic, because after that, you moved into 1943, and, well, there weren't any major German capital ship raids into the Atlantic, so you didn't need fleet carriers to try and hunt them down. Operation Torch had started a cascade of events that saw Vichy France fall, so you didn't have to worry about the Vichy French forces anymore because they were either scuttled or had joined the Free French. 1943, of course, saw the Italians bow out of the war, and so you didn't even need to cover the Mediterranean quite as much as you had done previously, and without the Germans ever commissioning any aircraft carriers, the carrier operations in the Arctic and the North Sea switched from defensive to primarily offensive operations. And of course, the Pacific was the big carrier furball. And that brings us to an end of this quickfire summary of the various major fleet carrier operations in the Atlantic during World War II. I hope that's been of some interest. And as I said, if any of those operations stick out to you, go, oh, I'd like to know a lot more about that particular one, then let us know in the comments below and we can expand on them in a bit more detail. But if we'd gone into more detail on every single one of them, this would have been a very, very, very long video indeed. So thanks for listening and see you again in another video.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.